A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's Seven Old Jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello and welcome to A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast brought to you by the University of Kent based on the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive. The British Stand-Up Comedy Archive exists to collect, preserve and make accessible material relating to stand-up comedy. In this podcast, we take one object from the archive per episode and discuss it to see what it can tell us about the history and form of stand-up comedy.
I'm Ollie Double, this is Elspeth Miller, and we are very much the Clarence and Joy Pickles of comedy archiving.
I do recognise that name, but I don't know. Have we not had that one before?
I don't think we have. If we have, then it's annoying. But I'm pretty
sure
we haven't.
Because I
keep meticulous records. So Clarence and Joy Pickles was a double act, male female double act, big in the 80s. They came out of a thing called the National Review Company, which is also what Arthur Smith came out of. And they were a kind of, you know, it was a character of double act, really. And I think, you know, you can find footage of them online. It's one of those acts that I never came across when I was on the circuit. And I really regret that I didn't, because go and find some footage. They're really funny. And their real names were Adam Wide and Babs Sutton. And basically, it was a kind of, they were playing a sort of, you know, upper class, you know, from a sort of middle class review, that kind of thing, you know, of the mid 20th century, you know, to sort of posh accents and like ironically old fashioned kind of thing. But just, you know, a really funny, like a great concept for act, really well realised, really well performed. And I like male female double acts as well. I think they're good.
I wonder if they were in one of the kind of brochures, like the Pranksters or the Cast New Variety.
Very, very possible. Yeah, I mean, they were quite a big name on the circuit, so it would be not surprising to me at all that you might have come across them in the archive. But we're not here to talk about that today, are we? What's the collection we're talking about today?
We're talking about the Peter Graham collection, which we've not done a full episode on yet.
No,
I think we've looked at some of Peter Graham's material in maybe the episode where we looked at Monica Babinska's bookings book
from
the Meccano Club.
Yeah.
So the Peter Graham collection is mainly to do with Downstairs at the King's Head, which is the club that Peter has run since 1983. The King's Head is in Crouch End, North London. So a lot of the collection is relating to that comedy club. So it's one of the, if not the, longest running comedy clubs.
I think it has a good claim to be Britain's oldest comedy club, because sure, the Comedy Store opened in 79, but that's been in three different venues. Downstairs at the King's Head has been Downstairs at the King's Head, as the name would suggest, since the early 1980s. And I mean, the only other ones that are around that are sort of similar vintage are, I think, the Bearcat in Twickenham and the Banana Cabaret in Balham, which has also been going since 83. But I think the Downstairs at the King's Head, I think its roots go earlier than 83. They certainly celebrated their 10th birthday in 93. But I think that there's a claim that they, you know, that they'd started doing things even before that kind of thing. So what's the object for today? Well, we couldn't decide really, could we?
No.
So what we thought we'd do is start the episode by just looking through a bunch of items from his collection. So do you want to?
Yeah, so I've bought a few bits and pieces from the stores. So one folder full of kind of the promotional leaflets that Peter made every month, titled What's On Downstairs at the King's Head, and then they were dated each month. So the earliest one that we have, we don't have any from the 80s actually, but it's April 94 is the earliest kind of listings, I suppose, that we have for them. And it's quite it's like an A4 piece of paper that's normally been folded in half. And it ran Saturdays and Sundays at this point. And some of the performers on this leaflet include Mark Thomas, Felix Dexter, who we spoke about recently. Oh, we've got Linda Smith. as well.
Yeah, I mean, I recognise a bunch of these now. I mean, Dylan Moran there.
Oh, yes, you've got. Yeah.
Marcus Simmons, who was mentioned in our Black Comedy Felix Dexter episode. Yeah, there's a bunch of interesting names there.
I've got Otis Cannelloni as well, who wasn't a straight comedian, was he?
He is, actually. I mean, he's still very much active. In fact, he's coming to do a show in Margate at the Tom Thumb Theatre coming up quite soon. I wrongly referred to his real name in a much earlier episode as, I think the Brown Paper Bag Brothers episode, as John Otis, which I got from a book. Somebody had said that in a book, but his actual name is John Korn, K-O-R-N. So, yeah, massive apologies to Otis / John, because that's rude of me, really, getting that wrong, even though I got it from a source. But he's still around. Yeah, he does kind of visual gags and... you'd say almost like magic, but not really magic, but, you know, kind of silly bits. He used to do a thing where he used to have like a thing you blow through that makes a sort of noise, but he pointed out that it sounded like a dentist drill. And it was great when he did it because it'd go, and people in the audience would wince. I mean, they'd be laughing, but you would hear people making groans, you know, because it was so light. It was actually like a dentist drill. I have strong feelings about dentists. Yeah, so a bunch of people. Oh, there's somebody else interesting in there.
Yeah, so this is, we've got the July 1994 leaflet as well. So we've got some well-known names. Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
Simon Munnery.
Simon Munnery, yeah.
Al Murray.
So Bernard Chumley, aka Matt Lucas.
Yeah. And at this point, everything was compared by Hugh Thomas as well.
Right. Yeah, I think he did it for much of its, through most of its early existence, didn't he? He did it for a long, long time, acting as a compere.
I think one of the reasons we wanted to do an episode on this collection was because of, I think, Peter Graham's, from people I've spoken to, he's got a really good reputation for helping young comedians out and doing kind of open mic nights and letting people have a shot. So in the August 94 brochure, we've got, there was a comedy tryout night on Thursdays.
Yeah.
And they did Edinburgh preview shows as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's worth saying that the early alternative comedy / alternative cabaret circuit was really idealistic. And people didn't necessarily go into it to make... I mean, there wasn't a huge amount of money to be made initially. So people didn't really go into it. Most people didn't go into it to make money. They went into it for other reasons, you know, because they enjoyed this stuff, maybe for political reasons, whatever. And the fact that he's one of the few sort of comedy club proprietors that's sort of still going after all these years, yeah, I think he's still got that idealism. And you could see that as a relic of a bygone era. Although, of course, there are still idealistic people who are just starting out today. I suppose what I'm trying to say is I'm just trying to praise idealism as a thing. It's a good thing. There should be more idealism in the world, I think.
One of the things I like about these leaflets, we've talked about this a lot, haven't we, about the kind of the homemade leaflets.
Yes.
And I think Peter made and designed all the leaflets himself. And in the collection, so down kind of the left and the right side of the leaflets, you've got some performer photos.
Yeah.
So within the collection, we've got some of those photos that he often, either people sent him.
Yeah.
Or he kind of cut out of like newspapers and magazines to kind of make a new leaflet.
But it's interesting because this one is slightly different from a lot of the earlier ones we have, which are just photocopy art. You know, in other words, it's somebody who's hand-drawn something, stuck a photo on, put it in a photocopier, maybe had it offset litho printed, that kind of thing. Whereas by the early 90s, more people had access to computers, and with computers it was much easier to get a slightly more professional look.
Oh, yeah, it's very designed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like... But what's interesting is, you know, you would never get... Well, most... comedy club publicity now would look a bit more ambitious than that because it's just easier to do things on computers now. This is a very early 90s computerised look, I think.
So we've got quite a few of these kind of monthly listings.
Yeah.
We've also got, I've put up, a folder of kind of promotional materials sent to Peter by acts themselves.
Yep.
So lots of those kind of performer kind of headshots and things like yep. that, or postcards advertising kind of themselves. So we've got one here, Tony Allen, that he sent to Peter.
And that's interesting because Tony's also a donor.
Yeah.
Tony, one of the key figures in the beginning of alternative comedy, here doing a show with Sharon Landau and guests. Sharon was is a singer. And he did a lot of work with Sharon Landau. So we did an earlier episode about comedians' headshots with Andy Hollingworth, the yeah. great photographer of comedians who's working today. And what's that one then?
So I've also brought up a folder of material about their 10th birthday celebrations,
okay.
which they had in September 1993. So this is, it's quite a practical folder, really, kind of like running instructions.
Yeah.
So things to do before the show set up, during the show, after show. There's kind of publicity for the kind of the birthday celebrations. So some of the people that they had performing at their 10th birthday were Joe Brand, Mark Lamar, Mark Thomas, Mark Steele, Steve Gribben, Younger and Parker, Jenny Lacote. Yeah, lots of familiar names now and kind of familiar on the circuit at the time.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And also, I'm just noticing that the thing, the show running instructions, it's quite an interesting document because it's basically a sort of standard sheet with printed kind of sections, but it's all handwritten, which speaks of a very sort of hands-on, personal approach of somebody who really cares about their venue.
Yes, we've got template blank versions of this in the collection.
Okay.
So, I mean, for this show, some of the before-show instructions were do up boards, chalk is in the sound room, paper is in the boiler room. Marker pen is in the cash box. Set out the room as usual. Ensure enough leaflets available. Get float money, etc. Check the lightings, all pointing in the right direction. And then there's a during show section. So doors open at 8. After show, the instructions were strike microphones. I'm not sure what that means.
Take them down.
Oh, okay.
It's theatre.
Ah.
Theatre lovey. Strike. Okay. Strike. We're going to strike the show now.
Okay. But you had to leave the cable and stand for the jazz, which was on Saturday, the day after. Anything else section was fill out the box office return, which is in the boiler room.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that because, you know, I would say the fact that that's handwritten shows the kind of cottage industry nature. And it goes back to that point about idealism in a way. This was a thing that people did because they really cared about it. At the same time, it was also, of course, a business. So box office returns is important. I remember we used to run comedy in Sheffield, the Last Laugh Comedy Club and the Merry Hell Comedy Club in the 90s. We used to run on a Thursday night and my job on Friday morning was adding up the money and, you know, putting all the, you know, noting it all down. And it's interesting that, though, because... Oh, no, I was going to say, yeah... I was just going to sort of say why had I not done that the night before so I could pay the acts? And the reason was because we paid a guaranteed fee. We didn't pay a door split. So we would have just paid them anyway. We would have had some money with us in case we didn't make the money on the door. But we always made money overall, but sometimes in one club we wouldn't quite break even. But then that would normally come out of our fee, if you see what I mean, our slice, and then we would even it up with the money taken at the other club.
Okay.
But it's an interesting thing. I suppose what I'm trying to say anyway is that you can be both idealistic and actually a business. You know, that those two, that makes me sound really Thatcherite. I don't mean it in that way. I'm a total lefty, but I suppose my point is I'm acknowledging the reality that it is small business. That's what it is. But also that it's more than that as well. As I think going back to your point about encouraging new acts, that's definitely true of Peter Graham, I'd say.
And then the rest of the collection, there is a lot to do with Downstairs at the King's Head, so kind of accounts and things like that. But there is material that's kind of not related. So that's why it's called the Peter Graham Collection rather than Downstairs at the King's Head. And one of the one of the bigger sections we've got is lots of comedy magazines that Peter collected. So we might do a future episode on kind of comedy magazines, but things like Comedy Review and Deadpan, those kind of early 90s kind of comedy magazines, which don't exist anymore in that form.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely should do an episode on that. Yeah, okay. So we've looked at a bunch of potential candidates for the object for today's episode. But I also interviewed Peter Graham on the telephone. And before we get any further with looking at objects, I thought we'd hear some clips from that. So the first thing that I wanted to clear up with him was that he sometimes goes by a slightly different name other than Peter Graham. So I asked him what we'd prefer to refer to him as in the episode, and here's what he said.
Well, I'm known as Peter Graham in the comedy world, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've also been a composer and all sorts of other things, and I set up Trestle Theatre when I left college. Lots of people don't know lots of things. I don't know the height of the Eiffel Tower, not including the radio mast, but I don't go around shouting about it.
It's worth saying that he was a delightful interviewee. I mean, like, gently and lightly playful, slightly impish, actually. And I really, really enjoyed talking to him. And that's a sort of flavour of the conversation that we had. Now, he also talks about how the Downstairs at the King's Head began.
Well, what happened was Hugh Thomas, who was the resident compere there for the first 20-odd years of the club running, he had been on the sort of folk circuit in the same way that the Billy Connollys and the Jasper Carrots had, and had got interested in what was beginning to happen at the store with the Gong Show and Alexis Sale. He went there a few times, loved the process of performing and doing some comedic routines and monologues and whatever, a bit of comedy songs. Always died to death, apparently. But one thing he came out of, he was my student, I was a student of his at Middlesex Poly, as was. And he lived in Crouch End, as did I at the time, and there was this room underneath the pub, and he said, we ought to do something like this, but in a more supportive, nurturing way rather than, the sort of bear pit ethos of the Gong Show. So that started in 81. We just did a couple of odd things in October, and then the following year did, three or four odd shows down there. We used to call it Comedy in the Cellar in those days, and it was £2 to get in, I think. I remember. And then that slowly developed until over the next 3 years, we were doing sort of a weekly show on a Sunday. And then in 86, we sort of took over doing stuff 7 days a week down there, mostly comedy. But that was the early days of the circuit, really. So we're fairly sure that we're the oldest comedy club still in its original home.
So, it's amazing that it's been around that long. I mean, 81, that's a long time ago now. I sort of put that to Peter how amazing it is that they've been around so long, and this is what he said.
Well, I mean, we know the clubs at the time, early clubs like Earth Exchange and Red Rose and all those have moved on or either have crumbled, Yeah, I mean, it's still a constant sort of face off with the brewery who actually own the bricks and mortar, but I think they've got to the point now where they realise it'd be silly to get rid of us.
So in this next clip, Peter talks about what the cabaret scene was like in the early days in comparison to today's comedy scene.
Anybody who was around, really. It was a nascent scene. I mean, there was... I've still to this day, I still believe that variety is the key and not, five stand-ups in a row or with middle-class, skinny trousers. But in the early days, it was certainly a mix of, you'd have at least one music act, probably straight music, at least one, what you would loosely term as a special act, a clown or a mime or magic or whatever, and that would often be straight-ish or more up down the sort of street entertainer theatre route. And then maybe two or three, what we would now regard as stand-ups, but it was very rough at the edges around then. I mean, I now see all these people, products of stand-up courses and, you know, evening classes and whatever, who are very slick in terms of being able to look the look and you know, take microphones out without banging themselves on the nose. They've got nothing to say. There was much more sort of content and risk-taking, I think, then than there is now. It's quite sort of mirrored what happened in the States a bit, what's happened over the years in this country, you know.
So Peter just talked about how the earlier acts had a lot more content than today. Hear him talk about some of the early acts that he liked.
Well, I mean, I like the silly stuff. I loved people like Podomoski and Frederick Benson, you know, Andrew Bailey's characters, and the Brown Paper Bag Brothers, which was John Hegley and Otis Cannelloni. You know, all these people are still going in some way or another. Andrew lives off air and lives in art installations in Berlin half of the time, but he's still somehow alive. You know. John Corn, Otis Cannelloni, is still working week in, week out. Not as much as he'd like to, he'll tell you. And obviously, Hegley was an outsider bet for the Poet Laureate, I think, and may yet come in. So Hugh and I used to like all the mad acts, I think. But then, there was early politicised, stand-up as well, which didn't really have a place before, I don't think. You know, I mean, Lenny Bruce had started all that over the other side of the Atlantic, but that was the early days of that, I think, in the sort of late 70s, where you could have the bile of somebody like Alexei, you know, just venting, you know.
So you've mentioned previously how the club has been kind of in existence since 81, but as Dan says at the King's Head, since 1983. In this clip, Peter talks about the special character of Downstairs at the King's Head.
Well, I could either be silly and just say we're just looking to get laid, but I failed and Hugh succeeded. No, what it was literally, and we stand to this today, which is that we look to nurture and give people a stage that is welcoming and not judgmental. I mean, yes, I mean, somebody's going to be, you know, I mean, very few times over the years have I actually told people not to come back, and that's because I found them properly offensive or dangerous or just plain, you know, nasty. But people can come and make mistakes there and return and make more mistakes. It doesn't matter, you know. It's a warm and supportive place. It might seem a bit hippie-ish these days. It's not. I know we're part of the humus triangle around there, but we still try and do that. And a lot of people like playing there for that very reason. And the bottom line still, in our case, is we are just a comedy club. You come in, you see a show, and then you fuck off at the end of the night. You don't eat a burger, and you don't dance, and all those things. You come in, you watch a good 2.5-hour show, which is curated by people who hopefully know what they're looking for, and you see people ready to perform, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really, really interesting what he says there, and it picks up on what you were saying about, you know, encouraging and helping new acts. One of the things I asked him, which is a kind of crucial point, is, okay, we're doing this episode and we're going to try and decide in the course of the episode which is going to be the object that we pick for the episode. And here's what he suggested.
You should take one of the diaries, flick it open with your eyes shut and put your finger on it, look, page, and just see what happens. Maybe worth going to 86, 87, okay. Because, you know, that was sort of... The circuit was sort of 5-6 years old then, I suppose, and you'd find some odd things in there, like John Sessions or, you know, very odd little people popping up, you know.
So, that's a great suggestion, I think. And we've got a couple of diaries here, right?
Yes. So we've got 1986.
Yep.
And 1987.
Fantastic. So we're going to take one of these each. And then we're going to flick it open at random, as he suggested, with eyes closed and see what comes up. Okay, what have you got there?
I opened it in July 1987. I've got Mickey Hutton.
Yep.
Mm, Can't read that name.
Well, you've got one crossed out, Belinda Blanchard, who was a stand-up. Ray Hanna, I think.
The Los Propentos?
No, I know who they were. Los Propertos. It was like a joke on lost property. It was a guy called Jonathan Mears, but he was known on the circuit as Johnny Immaterial. And he had like a band, I think, at one point, Los Propertos.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Simon Bly.
Yeah.
And Julie Ballou.
Yeah.
So this is Sunday. This week, there was only a show on Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's Sunday the 2nd of August, actually. Sorry, we're just into August.
Okay.
And next to Mickey Hutton's name, there's 15 in brackets.
That probably means he's only doing 15 minutes, is my guess. None of these... No, that's not true. I was going to say none of these names are familiar to me, but one of them is. The Reverend, I think that says Clem T. Lewis.
Yeah.
Something like that. And that's obviously a character act because you've got the real guy's name, which looks like it's Joel Greenberg. You've got his number there, which obviously I'm not going to read out on air in case it's still current. You've got Steve Bowditch, who was a sort of, was a name on the circuit when I was around. Used to do songs and things and comedy. And he was associated as well with the, at one point, with the Greatest Show on Legs, I think. And then Howard Lee, who is a juggling poet, apparently. Well, that was quite interesting, wasn't it?
Should we do a few others?
Yeah, we should definitely look through a bit more and see who else comes up, because they were quite interesting selections, but I bet we can find more interesting if we skip through.
So I've gone through to September.
Yeah.
Sunday, the 20th. So we've got Igor Thompson.
Yeah, Igor Thompson.
Was that Dave Thompson?
It is Dave Thompson. Dave Thompson of Teletubbies fame, who was the original Tinky Winky. And we recently did an episode with John Simmet, who was Dipsy. So we're collecting the Teletubbies set, that's for sure.
So alongside Igor Thompson, Ian Cognito.
Yeah.
Sonny and Fiona.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Bob Boynton.
Bob Boynton, yeah.
And Bernard Padden.
Yeah, okay, well, that's cool, because we know quite a few of those names. Dave Thompson talked about Ian Cognito was a big name on the circuit. Bernard Padden is somebody I've interviewed for my research. He's a very interesting guy. Turns up in a number of our different he turns up, for example, in Ivor Dembina's Pranksters brochures. I've got here Otis Cannelloni, Tim Clark, who is, it says here, stand-up Elpool, Liverpool, brackets good. Yeah, it was a good stand-up, Tim Clark. Belinda Blanchard, female stand-up. The Hall Brothers, who I think was Harry Hill.
Yeah.
Because he was originally known as Harry Hall. Yeah. And I think that was him in a double act. And it looks like the Burning Pestles doing 15. I don't know what they did, but it's a good name. Yeah, just trying to find some more. Mark Thomas here I've got.
Yeah, I've got Mark in here somewhere. I'm just looking, because at the back of... Oh, it's forward planning for 88. Okay, so we've got some forward planning.
Oh, there we go.
88 at the beginning, at the end of this volume. So already he'd booked in up to kind of March, really. So some of the names booked for 88 included the Crisis Twins, Igor Thompson again, Mark Steele, Andy Linden. I feel like that name's come up a few times.
Yeah, he was I remember him. It was I think he was an actor as well, Andy Linden. A Cockney guy. Very sort of distinctive looking. Quite funny, as far as I remember. Yeah, we've got a bunch of interesting names. I've got Harry Enfield here, 86. And Kevin McAleer on the same bill, this amazing Irish comic who did sort of surreal deadpan slideshow. Like showed images of owls and stuff and talked about them. Official touring, I noticed here, which I think official touring was Eddie Izzard's act. You've got David Thompson there, Captain Spliff, whoever that is, John Hegley, great John Hegley, Punt and Dennis, all on one bill.
So at this point, 86, 87?
Yeah, you're on 87.
It was a Sunday,
yeah.
Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
Whereas when we get to the 90s and we're looking at those leaflets from earlier, that was Saturday and Sunday and a few other nights.
I know this is quite interesting because we've got Felix Dexter playing on Sunday, the 20th of April, 1986. And why that's interesting is because in the interview I did with him in 1990, which was featured in an earlier episode, he said he started in 86. Well, it must have been quite early because it looks like he might be doing, what it looks like is he's doing 30 minutes.
I was going to ask, because they've got numbers next to them. So you think these are the minutes rather than the fee?
I do.
That's a really short set.
Yeah, 5 minutes. But I mean, 5 minutes for an open spot is quite normal.
Okay.
So you got, because that would put Arnold Brown on 45 minutes, which would make sense by 86. I bet Arnold was quite capable of doing 45. Andy Greenhalgh, who I remember quite well on the circuit, and Ian Keeble, both of those, I think it was a magician. They're doing 25 apiece. Felix is doing 30, and there's an act doing what I guess is a paid half spot, the Hoons, whoever that is.
So do you think this is in the running order as well, or not? Because Arnold would be last, would he not?
Good question. Yeah, it wouldn't be starting with Arnold. Arnold would be last, yeah, for sure. I don't know. That's a good question whether that was running order, because I would have thought that if you've got a five-minute unpaid open spot, Michelle Reed, I would have thought that she would probably go earlier in the evening. It would seem a bit mean to leave her till just before the headliner, before putting her on.
So do you think, looking at this, because you're a lot more familiar than I am with the acts,
that
there's still that cabaret,
definitely
element represented?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, here we go. Official touring. You know, I said I thought it was Eddie Izzard. It says official touring, and it's got Eddie Izzard and his number from the time. And that's quite interesting. Teatro d'Existenziale, Charmian. That's Charmian Hughes. She used to go under that name. That's a great bill, actually. That is a great bill. Actually, I'm going to go back on what I said before for the money, because I think that is probably the money paid.
Okay.
I don't think the Brown Paper Bag Brothers would have been doing 70 minutes. Probably not. So that would put it at Brown Paper Bag Brothers, 70 quid. Steve Edgar, who is a really good comic, who I perform with at a club called Spots, with a Z rather than S at the end, in Nottingham in 86, around this time. And he was just a great sort of slightly surreal observational comic. I remember tons of his, because it was like an important experience for me. It was the first time I played in a professional, although I was being an unpaid open spot, it was the first time I played in a professional, you know, comedy club. And Hattie Hayridge was also on the bill. And the other act was a theatre company. But anyway, Steve Edgar was on, and he was so good. I really regret that he's sort of fallen into obscurity, because so Brown Paper Bag Brothers, Steve Edgar, Teatro, so that's Charmian Hughes. You've got Eddie Izzard doing a official touring with his partner, and you've got Rosie Gibb, whoever that is. So that's a double act with Brown Paper Bags. That's not a straight stand-up. So that fits the question about... then you've got a straight stand-up. Then I don't know how much Charmian's act was straight stand-up at that point, but then you've got a double act based on street performance and whatever Rosie Gibb was doing. So, yeah, definitely. There's definitely... Gary Howard was a singer, for example.
So do we think... So it's not a door split basis like the Meccano was... It's hard to tell, isn't it?
Because
there's not numbers next to everything.
There's not numbers next to everything. I mean, that's another interesting bill. You've got Gary Howard, who was a singer. You've got Pierre Hollins, who at that time was a juggler. Ivor Dembina, who was a comedian. Strange Fruit was replaced by somebody else, but Strange Fruit was a three-woman a cappella singing group. And Patricia, whoever she is. Yeah, I don't know why it wasn't an even split from the door. It's all ifs, isn't it? That is what I think, because I don't think you'd have an act in a mixed bill of comedy doing an hour and 10. I think it must be that. I think I got it completely wrong before.
This one's quite interesting. From 87, December 87, it's the Christmas special. So it's Los
Propertos
again. Marc Lamar. Richard someone. I can't read the surname.
Neither can I. That's weird, isn't it?
Jim Tavare.
And Tavare,
and Lily Savage.
Yeah. Lily Savage, wow.
Yeah, so is that...
Yeah,
was he performing at that point?
That's definitely Lily Savage, yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't know that. I never came across a Lily Savage on the circuit, never. So, yeah, they are really interesting documents. They've got a lot less... They're a lot less compact than the Meccano bookings book, which starts in 87. You know, you can go through a couple of pages and that's 2 months worth of gigs. Whereas in here, you've got, you know, it's like a bunch of blank diary pages and then the Sunday filled in.
Yes, yeah, so the 87 one is the Letts 1987 diary.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and this one is, I don't know what this brand of diary is, but yeah, it's a proper diary rather than just a notebook.
And it's mainly business related rather than like any personal.
Yeah, there's no personal stuff in here that I found. Yeah, it's a fascinating set of acts, both people that I've heard of and people that I just haven't. Most of them I think I've heard of, but yeah, it's good. It's really nice, really good suggestion. So that's quite interesting. I don't know what this means, but Pinder of Wakefield was a venue, was a pub. It's called something different. I think it's called the Water Rats now. So I don't know why that's mentioned there. It might be something else he was doing, maybe, as well as doing Downstairs at the King's Head. It's a bunch of interesting acts. He was an interesting act, Lindsay Moran. He did a kind of comedy and accordion playing act. Very interesting guy. Okay, we've had a look at these. Which one do you think we should pick?
I think your 86 one.
Okay.
Because 87 doesn't have any figures next to it.
Okay.
Not that we know exactly what the figures
mean. We don't
mean,
really know what the figures
still.
Mean. Okay, but what I thought we'd do is now hear some more of the interview. So actually, interestingly, here's what Peter says about the fees paid.
Well, the other thing that, you know, I sort of said, and I don't mind saying this on the podcast, one thing about that collection that you had to be a bit careful with, and it may be the case with other bits you have from like the Meccano Club, I often wrote fees and stuff into the diaries or agreed things. Obviously, that's to some extent, I don't think many people would mind now. Yeah. But the interesting thing, if you look at the fees, is they haven't changed much in the last 30 years. Yeah. Not radically. And I think there's a theory, I think there's certainly somebody could do a thesis on this, that it's always tracked, the 20-minute spot has always tracked this exact same price, street price, as a gram of cocaine.
He's cheeky, isn't he? He is cheeky, there's no doubt about that. I think that's a really interesting point. I've no idea, because I've never been somebody who's into kind of drugs and stuff. But, yeah, well, that's an interesting idea. Somebody could go and research that, maybe.
We have talked about kind of using these books and looking at, well, as you do yourself, looking at kind of how fees have changed since kind of the 80s. Because we do have some really good sources in this collection and the Meccano collection.
Absolutely. I mean, it is interesting. I've talked to comics that I knew when I was on the circuit who've said, we get paid the same as we used to get paid when you were doing it. And bear in mind, I stopped doing it in 99. I mean, I have done it since, but, you know, not, you know, stopped doing it regularly since 99. And they go, it's sort of like we get paid the same, but sometimes we get paid a bit less. And that's weird. And I can only think that it's to do with an oversaturated market or possibly the inability of clubs to get punters in nowadays. You hear a lot, if you talk to comedians about that, you know, that it's harder to get punters in. Because people don't like paying for things now because of online culture. You know, we expect to get music for free. So, and I've heard things as well. I don't know if this is true, but students have said to me, well, I tried to get some of my friends to come to our comedy night that we're doing. But they said, why would I come out of my room when I could see the best comedians of the world on Netflix for free? Which I find a deeply depressing attitude, if that is indeed true.
not very supportive.
It's totally unsupportive. It sucks in a big way. He sort of already touched on this, but I asked him how comedy had changed since 81 when he started.
We run since 86, September, October 86, we've run a tryout night every Thursday. And with 1 or 2 weeks break between Christmas and New Year, that's run every Thursday, and we see up to 14 acts doing 5 minutes. So through that, I can observe really how things change. I think, you know, because the circuit's now 30 years old, 35 years old, there is a mirroring of what happened stateside, and particularly on the West Coast, where it had a boom, it had the freshness of a new art form or a new performance form. And then what happens is it sort of beds in, and then you get an infrastructure of agents and power brokers and big money throwing. I mean, now we're looking at people filling 5,000-10,000 seaters just with one microphone and two lighting states. Boy, oh boy, do theatres love that. No sets, you know, no extraneous costs. So, you know, there's a whole mechanism and industry now that didn't exist at that time. And as such, it's gone through two or three sort of phases. There's the nascency of people, you know, what's the word, fumbling around, finding their feet and the circuit finding how it worked. Then a sort of bedding in of a standard sort of shape to most evenings, you know, compare 3, maybe 4 acts, 2, maybe 1 interval. And there was an interesting thing that happened with the two major magazines at that time, which was City Limits and Time Out, where Time Out stopped calling it a cabaret section and started calling it a comedy section. So suddenly that forced people to see these as comedy nights rather than nights of varied entertainment with a comedic bent. And then, you know, since then, we've had courses build up around within the industry, and people, you know, I can tell a Jill Edwards graduate, you know, when they do their first 5 minutes with me. I can tell a Logan Murray graduate. I can tell by the way they perform, the way they do stuff. And I can also tell certain acts who, I can tell their influences, that, you know, they're very much, you know, they like Stuart Lee or Milton Jones or Harry Hill or whatever. You get people now wanting to emulate what they've seen on comedy. And of course, some people now are coming to comedy through television, and some are coming through large scale events rather than the best route, the most honest and purest route, which is through the clubs and the sticky carpets. That's where you learn your trade. You know?
Yeah, one of the things that's quite interesting is that, and you hear this a lot when you talk to people who are involved in the early comedy / cabaret scene, that people didn't know what they were doing. They were having to sort of find out as they went along how it all worked, which I find very exciting. And it goes back to the idea of idealism. If there's no sort of established career structure, then you have to find your own way. And I think that takes a particular mindset, which I think in our increasingly sort of pressured and conformist society, I think that that's something that we can really learn from that. And here he talks about that sort of phenomenon.
But we didn't know. There was no rule book. But now there's this sort of set thing that... and the worst possible thing, is if you get picked up too early by one of the big agencies and then thrown in to sort of just doing support jobs in council theatres in Shrewsbury on a Tuesday night, you know. And you don't really learn much then, and you often find a lot of those people just sort of drift to one side into writing and don't realise their potential. I think we are coming full circle now with our era of comics beginning to really moan about the next, which is how this circuit started. Yeah. You know, with the old chicken in the basket comics saying, well, this lot just so say fuck a lot and don't play golf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I knew that had changed when I saw two acts discussing their swing in the dressing room, you know. So we knew that we'd come full circle at that point. And now we've got a lot of people moaning that they can't get work. Yes, it's tough times and there's less work out there, but that's partly reflective of the entertainment business and the country as a whole, and it's going to get worse in the next 2 years. I mean, luckily, touch wood, clubs like ours will keep going because they are pure and we invest in the next generation. But there's a lot of comics sitting on their arse at the moment, not being proactive, not adapting, and they're going to become the same dinosaurs that the Bernard Mannings became. And there's a lot of comics now setting up their own world, their own geeky nights, their own science nights, their own whimsy nights. That's fine. I think they'd struggle on a Friday night in Romford, but that's their audience, you know. I think your best bet is to have a wide skill set, and that is by playing, you know, to nine demented 80-year-olds in a home on a Friday afternoon, and then later in the evening doing a rough gig after a disco, you know. That's where you get your chops. But I grew up in a showbiz family. My parents met actually doing the Benny Hill show in Bristol, long before Benny Hill was a TV act. And as a result, you know, a lot of my dad's friends, people who I would see in theatres or in TV studios or around our house, were the, you know, the Benny Hills and whatever. I remember one morning Ernie Wise, my dad saying to Ernie Wise, where were you last night? And this was at the time when they were, this would have been early 70s, mid-70s, when they were, you know, there were two TV stations and they were preeminent Saturday night, you know, 20 million people watching every week. And I remember Ernie Wise saying, oh, we did Sheffield last night, died the death. And, you know, if at that stage, I remember thinking at the time, blimey, you know, if you think you've cracked it, you're an idiot. You know, you really are. If you think you've had six gigs and you've done it and they've got all gone well and that's it, then you're going to have to take those slaps in the face. You know, that's part of this business. In the same way, missing an open goal in soccer, that's part of the game, you know.
So, yeah, I think that's quite an interesting long view that he takes there. That the idea that you've never cracked it, that you constantly need to be aware that there might be something around the corner that you don't do, that however successful you are as a comedian, for example, you might suddenly come across an audience that you don't like you or something like that. It's always possible to get it wrong. And I think that's one of the things I find very interesting about stand-up as a form is that it's never done. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the scripts that we have in the collection is that they're never a verbatim script of an actual performance. It's always work in progress, and the work develops through multiple performances and changes. The routines grow and shrink and tighten and expand and all that kind of thing. And I think the same is true of running things. You know, sometimes you realize you've done it wrong and you need to change and find a new way of doing it and that kind of thing. Actually, I think, to be honest, I truly think this, that I think that people on the circuit, the people who've got the right idea, the people who don't take anything for granted, don't go, oh, I know how it works, this is how you do it, but actually come to it fresh and go, well, I'm going to run a club in a different way. You know, and I don't see why, you know, for example, in the 80s, going to comedy was a young people's thing. It was. You know, you go and watch footage or you talk to anybody. It was a thing that young people probably largely under the age of 30, actually, or certainly under the age of 40.
Is this alternative comedy?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. The early alternative comedy / alternative cabaret circuit was really mainly younger performers, mainly younger audience. It was like in that sense, it was like live music. You know, it was mainly a young people's game. And it's just not now. And if anything, I think young people think, this is an exaggeration, but I think to some extent young people think of stand-up as being an old person's thing, you know, an older person, middle-aged thing, you know. And I suppose that's partly because the people who's still into comedy, you know, either as performers or audience members, when Peter Graham was starting it downstairs at the King's Head, are, of course, now middle-aged, well into middle-age. But there's no reason why it can't be, you know, about young people and, you know, young people's culture and also sort of oppositional and radical, like as it used to be. There's no reason why it can't. And it, of course, there are areas where it still is. And they're the people who've got the right ideas, I think. But of course, this podcast isn't just about us telling you things. It's also about the various ways in which you can get involved.
Get involved!
There are various ways that you can get involved in this podcast, but first you'll need to know how to contact us. You can email us via standup@kent.ac.uk, that's standup, all one word, no hyphen, @kent.ac.uk, or you can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @histcompod.
So the first way you can get involved is go to the online catalogue for the Stand-Up Comedy Archive, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it. We'll talk about all nominated objects in future episodes. That's the vanilla version of getting involved.
The chocolate chip version of getting involved is to come and visit the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive in the Templeman Library at the University of Kent. If you record a short piece about the object that you've seen, send us the audio and we'll feature it in a future episode.
And the stupidest way of getting involved, let's call it the tutti frutti way, is to record your own cover version of our theme tune for the podcast. Send it to us, and if we like it, we'll feature it in a future episode. Just to let you know, if you do get involved, we will give you rewards like podcast badges, British Stand-Up Comedy Archive t-shirts, and that kind of pizzazz, if that's a word. It is now.
A History of Comedy in Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hoss.